So one of the things that we as a family have learned over the years, especially recently, is that if we're going on a trip, driving is a lot more relaxing than flying. And it's not because road trips are super easy, it's because of the packing. When you're packing into a car, you can just throw everything in there. It doesn't even need to be in a bag. When in doubt, you're just sort of like, should we bring this along? Throw it in there, no problem. It's very different when you're packing for a flight, especially if you don't want to pay for checked baggage, which we don't. So we're trying to fit everything we have in bags that will fit into the carry-on holders. And so that means frequently when we're packing, we have to keep coming back to the same question. And that question is, do you need it? The question with the toy is not, is it a good toy? Is it a nice toy? Do you enjoy the toy? The question is, do you need it? It'll be there when you get back. Do you absolutely need it on this? Actually, one of the greatest inventions that I've enjoyed over the past decade has been the Kindle, because it used to be that when I was going on a trip, even if it was like, I'm going to be gone for 5 days, I would pack like 8 different books, because when you're going on vacation, you're like, who knows what's going to happen here? And who knows how bummed I'm going to be if I want to read this book, but I don't have access for it. So back in that time, when I was packing for a trip, it wouldn't be the question of, is this a good book or will I enjoy this book? The question was, do I need it? Because I have limited space, do you need those shoes? Do you need that extra sweatshirt? Do you need that extra notebook? Do you need it? And this is a question you ask whenever you're dealing with the whole idea of limitations. We have limited space. We can't pack everything. So the question is not, is the thing that you want to pack something good? The question is, do you need it? And we ask a question like this for a lot of different circumstances in our lives whenever we're dealing with limitations. We have limited time. And so the question might not be, hey, is that a good activity to do? It's just, is that something you need? Is that something that you're going to prioritize so high that it's going to take time away from other things? We all have limited money. And so the question is not, is that an okay thing to buy? It's just, is that high enough on the priority list that you'll not purchase something else to purchase that? Do you need it? That's a question we keep coming back to. And it's not just in our lives when it comes to our schedule, our time, and our money. It's also a question that eventually we have to ask when it comes to Jesus. So we're the year 2023. We're in Southern California. Let me just ask a question. Are there people around us who are hostile to Jesus? Yeah, absolutely. There are people that if a conversation comes up about Jesus, they will have a level of hostility. That's not most people, though. Most people around us who are not believers in Jesus are not saying, I would never want anything to do with Jesus. For them, the question is not, is Jesus good? Is Jesus nice? Is Jesus smart? The question is what? Yeah, do I need him? I don't have anything against Jesus. I think it's fine that you like Jesus, but do I need him? That's the question that we come back to. And there might be some of you in here right now that you haven't put your faith in Jesus right now. And honestly, you would say, that's really what I'm dealing with. I don't have some vendetta against Jesus. I've just yet to become convinced that I need him. And for those of us who have placed our faith in him, we still deal with this question. You might think you don't, because you might think, no, I came to a point in my life where I realized I did need Jesus, and that's why I put my trust in him. But we're still living day in, day out, and we still have to deal with the question, all right, do I need Jesus enough to go to him and get his wisdom? Do I need Jesus enough to go to him to get comfort or help or strength? Is he high enough on the priority list that I'll deprioritize other things that seem good? The question for us as Christians is not even, do we believe in Jesus, but do we really believe that we need him? Because if we don't believe that we need him, we're probably not going to draw near. this question, kind of the variation of the question on the screen, the question, do you need Jesus, is the question at the center of our passage today in Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 through 13. I'm going to share a couple more things, but if you have a Bible, you can go ahead and turn there because that's where we're going to be, Matthew 9, verses 9 through 13. And we're in the midst of chapters 8 and 9. They sort of go together as a group, as a unit. And I mentioned this last week, but in case you weren't here or in case you don't remember, we're doing something a little bit different now as we move through the rest of the book of Matthew. So for chapters 1 through 7, we went through every passage, every verse, verse by verse. What we're going to be doing through the rest of the book is that we are going to choose one passage, one specific passage from each chapter, and we're going to zero in on that and use that as our focus for the day, just in the same way that last week we were in chapter 8, so we did verses 5 through 13, the story of the centurion servant being healed. Today we're in chapter 9, we're doing verses 9 through 13, the story of Matthew being called. The reason that we're doing this is because if we went through every single passage in Matthew, just passage by passage, verse by verse, we'd be doing this series for about 3 years, which some of you would be like, let's do it for 3 years. But we feel like, no, we want to get the big picture of Matthew. We want to continue to progress through it and get the big picture. And so in between the passages, we'll sum up what's going on. In fact, I'll do that with chapters 8 and 9 right now, because in Matthew 8 and 9, there's really two things going on. The stories go back and forth between one of two themes. One theme is Jesus' miraculous power. In fact, that's the main theme. You see that all throughout chapters 8 and 9. You see Jesus healing a leper. Then you see Jesus healing the centurion's son from a distance. You see him healing blind people and mute people. You see him casting out demons. You see him calm a storm when they're out on the boat. Throughout Matthew 8 and 9, Matthew, as he's writing this, he is establishing, so that none of us have any doubt, Jesus is supreme over the physical realm. He can tell the wind and the waves, stop, and they stop. He is also supreme over the human body because he is able to speak to disease and disease stops. And he's also supreme over the spiritual realm. Because no matter how long a demon has been tormenting somebody, at the word of Jesus, they flee. So Jesus' supremacy over everything is being put on display. So we see miracles, but the second theme that we see in Matthew 8 and 9 is the theme of discipleship. In other words, what does it look like to follow Jesus? So we really get three main passages that flesh this out. And in chapter 8, we get a passage where Jesus talks about the cost of discipleship. It's not free. You have to leave things behind to follow Jesus. At the very end of chapter 9, the last passage in chapter 9, Jesus talks about how his disciples are called to go out and be workers for the harvest. That Jesus has people that he's saving, and those who follow him are part of doing that work to bring them in. And then the third passage about discipleship is our passage today, Matthew 9, verses 9 through 13, and it's the passage about Jesus calling a disciple to himself, and that's what we're going to focus on now. In fact, let's focus in on it right now by starting in verse 9. We read, as Jesus went on from there, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. Follow me, he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. So we get the story of Jesus calling a disciple, and just for clarity's sake, when Jesus is calling Matthew here, he's not just calling him to become a Christian, even though that's part of it. He is calling him to be his disciple, to be his student. This is something that first century rabbis did. And typically, it was young men who were already showing a strong propensity to be all about God and to be all about the Torah, and maybe they want to be rabbis themselves one day. Jesus stops to call a disciple, and he calls him from a tax collector's booth. And this disciple is named Matthew. Although some of you may know that the story shows up in Mark and Luke also, in both of their gospels, they tell this same story, but the name is not Matthew. Anybody know what the name is? Yeah, some of you know it. It's named Levi. But everything else about the story is exactly the same. And so we're left to there. This is definitely the same guy. This is definitely the same story that he goes to the tax collector's booth. He calls Matthew here. He calls Levi in Mark and Luke. And so the clear conclusion is that this is the same guy. Matthew and Levi, same person. So some people wonder, well, why does he have two names? Well, first of all, there's lots of people in the Bible. If you've read the New Testament, this actually happens quite a lot. In fact, Mark, who wrote the Gospel of Mark, shows up in the book of Acts, and his name in Acts, if you know it, is? Yeah, John Mark. He has John and he has Mark. So this could be as simple as that, that this is Matthew, Levi, Levi, Matthew. Some other people think that this is actually a nickname, that maybe he was from the tribe of Levi, and so the disciples just called him Levi, even though his actual name was Matthew. That's possible too. There are nicknames in the Bible. Jesus meets a man named Simon, and what does he nickname him? Yeah, nicknames him Peter, the rock. So this happens. So either way, whatever's going on, whether this is a nickname or whether this is just two names, this is clearly the same guy. He stops at a tax collector's booth and he calls Matthew. He stops at a tax collector's booth. Now let's put two and two together. Why do you think Matthew was sitting at a tax collector's booth? Good job. It's not a trick. It's because he's a tax collector. And I know today we could look at it, and even in 2023, we could say, well, we don't really like tax collectors now. I mean, nobody's excited about hearing from the IRS, so we have this idea in our head, all right, tax collectors, we're not popular people. They weren't popular people then. They're not popular people now. Sorry if you work for the IRS. Maybe don't tell anyone. I'm just kidding. We welcome tax collectors here. But the idea, yeah, some of you are maybe not. The idea here wasn't just that people might be scandalized by Jesus calling a tax collector because they're like, we don't like paying taxes. He does something. He does a job that we don't like to do. It was that tax collectors were universally, in the first century, they were universally corrupt. They would use their position, and it was expected. Rome expected them to use their position to line their own pockets. Let me pause for a quick story. So right after I graduated from college, me and four friends went to Russia for a couple of months for a long-term mission trip over in Russia. We worked with a missionary. He was driving us around in a certain region in Russia, and the missionary's name was Chad. He got pulled over by the police. And we all kind of watched during this traffic stop because it went differently than any traffic stop we had experienced before. So Chad got out of the car. First of all, he just got out of the car when he got pulled over, which we were like, you don't do that here. Wait at your window for the cop to come. He got out of his car and kind of, you know, went right up to the police officer. They talked for a while. They went back and forth. Then eventually Chad came back to the car and we kept driving. And we were sort of like, what just went down? That was weird. And Chad related to us the conversation that went down between him and the police officer. And I'll kind of give you the sense of how that conversation went. It went like this. So you were speeding. I'm so sorry I was speeding. I didn't realize I was speeding. I shouldn't have been doing that. Well, you were. And so now you need to come down to the station and we're going to give you a fine. You know, I have a lot going on today. I have a pretty busy schedule. Is there any way I can just pay the fine right now? I'm not sure. It might be a pretty big fine. You were going pretty fast. Okay, well, I'd like to pay the fine now if I could. How much should I pay for this fine? Do you think $50 would be an appropriate amount to pay for this fine? I don't think $50 is enough. You were going pretty fast. I think the fine is probably going to be more like $100. $100 seems too high for the fine for what I did. Maybe the fine should be $70. Is the fine $70? I think $70 is closer to what the fine is. Maybe $75 is what the fine is. $75 seems like an appropriate amount for the fine. He paid him $75, got back in the car, and we drove off. Chad related this story to us, and we were like, did you just bribe a police? Like, what? Just, this is the most bizarre thing we've ever heard. This is not the way traffic stops go down here. There's a set amount that you pay, and it's all established. And then if you want to protest it, you can go and ask for a lower fine. But it was so bizarre to hear about this bartering over the fine. The reason that they were bartering over the fine is because that fine wasn't going any further than that police officer's pocket. It was going in there, and it was going to stay there. So his approach was to figure out, how much can I get out of this traffic stop? It was all negotiable. That's why at a traffic stop like that, you don't ask how much the fine is, because if you ask how much the fine is, they ask, how much you got? They want to squeeze as much as possible. And he just explained to us like that it's a bribe of sorts. That's the way things just are here. This is the way every police officer, every time you get pulled over, this is just the way that it goes. This is just the kind of corruption that happens with the police officers in this region of Russia at that time. Now, that is some sort of picture of what the corruption was like for tax collectors. The idea wasn't that the Israelites would say, hey, you got to watch out because there are some corrupt tax collectors. The tax collectors as a whole just were corrupt. They'd be collecting taxes from you, and they'd be like $50 for Rome and another $20 for me. $65 for Rome and another $15 for my pocket. That's how they made money. And so they were well off. And not only did the Jewish people not like them because they were corrupt, they didn't like them because these were Jewish people who had sided with Rome, with the occupying power, and were in cahoots with them to rob their own countrymen. Tax collectors were not popular people, and yet Jesus stops and calls a tax collector from his booth. This is shocking. And what's almost as shocking is the way that Matthew responds. Because look at the very end of verse 9. And Matthew got up and followed him. Now, Matthew is the only tax collector disciple of Jesus that we know about. A lot of Jesus' disciples had other jobs. In fact, what's the job that comes up the most? Fisherman comes up the most. Now, there's a sense in which the fishermen left their jobs, but it was only in this sense. It was that their fishing was deprioritized. There still are stories of them going out on their boats and catching fish, because if you're traveling around with Jesus, you can still have a free day where you go out, get some fish, sell them, and make a little bit of money. Matthew did not have that option. Matthew couldn't follow Jesus around and then just go back and collect some taxes whenever he had some free time. When Matthew leaves the tax collector's booth, he is leaving his job. One commentator was saying that I was reading this week was saying that Matthew probably left behind more than any other individual disciple of Jesus. He had a lucrative job, and he left it behind. And whether or not Matthew said anything out loud, this is kind of the internal dialogue that I imagine with Matthew when he got called. That Matthew is looking at his job, and here's the question he asks about his job. Do I need it? I mean, it's making me a good living. It's keeping me protected. I'm richer than all the other Jews because I'm in here with Rome. But do I need it? And then he looked at Jesus. And you know what question he asked? Do I need him? Do I need this miracle worker? Do I need this possible Messiah? Do I need this Savior? He looked at his job and he looked at Jesus, and he decided that Jesus was more important than anything that he would be leaving behind. This is a powerful story, and it illustrates the idea that Jesus has already talked about earlier in chapter 8, which is if we are going to follow Jesus, it requires us to leave some things behind because Jesus is that much of a priority. Jesus calls Matthew. Matthew leaves behind his job to follow Jesus. And that's actually just the start of this story, because something happens right afterwards in verses 10 and 11. Verse 10, we read, while Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. For Matthew, this is a little bit of a world's colliding party going on here. Matthew is like, I have some new friends. I have Jesus in my life right now. Jesus has a lot of disciples. They're now basically my co-workers. He invites them all to a party at his house, but he invites his new friends. And he also invites his old friends. So we got Jesus and his disciples. We've got tax collectors and sinners. And this brings up a problem that the Pharisees expose in verse 11. It says, when the Pharisees, who were the religious leaders among the Jewish people, says, when the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? And it would be easy for us today to say, what are these guys so worked up about? It's just a meal. Like, it doesn't say Jesus was getting drunk. It doesn't say that he was suddenly becoming corrupt. He's just eating a meal. What's the big deal with a meal? Well, if you've ever gone to high school before, you know that it can be a big deal who you eat with. It can be a big deal to get invited to eat with a certain group of people. And sometimes people get mad when they're like, hey, who said you could invite that guy to come eat with our group? We all have experienced this. And even as adults, sometimes there are still instances where we experience this, where eating with somebody, especially going to their house, makes a signal about belonging to that group. Beyond that, in our culture, we recognize the power of association. I don't know if you've noticed, but with people, photographs that are 10, 15, 25 years old have been dug up from people who had a meal with a now controversial figure, and they have been canceled over these sorts of things. So even today, we can say, what's the big deal? It's just a meal. We still do this. We still have this sense of, if you're associated with them, then you're in with them. And for the Pharisees, they're saying, if you're at Matthew's house, eating with tax collectors and sinners, that is like an implicit endorsement of their lifestyle. And don't miss that it says he wasn't just eating with tax collectors, he was eating with tax collectors and sinners. Now, this is hard for us to understand today because the popular way that we use the word sinners today is just to refer to the fact that we all sin. So we're like, we all sin, so we're all sinners. So it seems weird that they're talking about a certain set of people as sinners. And here's what's going on here. There's very little evidence that the Pharisees thought some people sinned and others didn't. They probably wouldn't have said, I never sin as a Pharisee. But they were categorizing certain people as sinners. Let me give you an illustration. I sometimes run. I do. I sometimes run. If you had a video of my life, like 24 hours a day, you would be able to pinpoint times when I run. When it's this hot during the summer, the most frequent example might be if I'm taking something out to the outside trash can and I want to really quickly get back inside to the AC, I might run that 25 feet back inside. So sometimes I run. You definitely can find me sometimes running. Am I a runner? I am not a runner. Some of you are runners. God help you. You like to run. You do it by choice. You even claim to enjoy it. The rest of us aren't sure we believe you. You are a runner. I am not. And you can say, but Dan, you run, therefore you're a runner. Well, no, I run occasionally, sometimes accidentally, but it's not something that marks me. It's not something that identifies me. This is what's going on with sinners. The Pharisees are saying, we're not just saying these guys that you're with, that they sometimes mess up, that they sometimes stumble in sin. We are saying these are the people in our society who are marked by living sinful lifestyles. They're loud and they're proud about it. They're not even hiding it. These are the corrupt judges in our culture and everybody knows about it. These are the pimps and the prostitutes in our culture and everybody knows it. These are the drunkards in our culture. These are the people who aren't just occasionally sinning. They are marked by their sin. They are sinners. And so they have to ask the question, Jesus, why in the world would you share a table with corrupt tax collectors and with people marked by sin? Jesus has an answer for them, and it's in the final verses, probably the most important verses of this passage, verses 12 and 13. On hearing this, Jesus said, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick." This statement actually is where we get one of the nicknames for Jesus, that he sometimes is called the great Yeah, the great physician, the great doctor. Anybody in here today, I'm not going to ask you any specifics, anybody here today feel like you could use a little treatment from Dr. Jesus? You're just like, yeah, actually, I could use some help from him because I'm feeling guilt or shame or hurt or trials. He's the great physician. He says, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the sick who need a doctor. And then he says, but go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. We'll come back to this a little bit later. He's quoting from Hosea. This is Hosea 6:6, if you want to look it up later. Jesus here is, I think, being a little bit snarky. You notice how he introduced this quote? Go learn what this means. He's talking to the religious scholars of his age, saying, maybe you need to go back and read your Bible and actually learn what it means. Go learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And that's God talking. And God actually clearly did want sacrifice because he set up a whole sacrificial system. But he's saying, you know what's even more important to me than sacrifice? You know what's even more important to me than ritual? It's mercy. It's compassion. And the Pharisees are showing none of that. He says, I'd rather have mercy than sacrifice. And finally, he says, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Here's the crux of the whole passage, this final statement. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Now, in some ways, if you are one of the sinners, one of the labeled sinners in this group right now, you might not initially feel like this is the best thing Jesus could have said. Today, what we would hope for Jesus to say is that the Pharisees look and they say, there are sinners in there. And that Jesus would respond in saying, you guys are wrong, they're not sinners. That's what we would want today. Because you feel bad if you're called a sinner. You don't feel good about yourself. So our solution today to our sin is to assure ourselves that we're not sinners. We just feel better about that. Let me give you another quick illustration. So this happened when I was back in seminary. I was taking a counseling class. And what they asked us to do, they had us pair up with somebody else in the class, and they said, all right, bring up sort of like an emotional or a personal problem that you're having, and then kind of talk it through with this other person, just to practice with each other. So the problem that I brought up with my partner, so I said, you know what, I've always felt like I'm just a very average person, and so sometimes I wonder, like, does God actually really care about me? Because I feel like there's nothing about me that really stands out. I'm just very, very average. And my partner and I were talking about this, and the professor came over and listened to us for a while, and then she decided to insert herself in the conversation. Now, here's what I want to say. What she said was definitely well-intentioned, and for some of you, you might be like, that would have been meaningful for somebody to say this to me. I'm just going to tell you it did not land for me. So I'm bringing up this problem. My problem is, I don't know, I have a hard time believing God really cares about me because I feel very average. Here's what she said. She said, I've always thought that God must care a lot about average people because he made so many of them. Huh. Now, once again, some of you might be like, that was a great thing to say. I'm not even saying it wasn't a great thing to say, I'm saying it's not what I wanted to hear. What she basically said is, yeah, you're right. Nothing remarkable here. Like, you look pretty average to me, but good news, God loves average people. What did I want her to say? I wanted her to say, no, are you kidding me? Dan, you're not average. Dan, you are remarkable. There are all these amazing things about you. That's what I want. That's what my heart was longing for. Instead, I got the news, yeah, you're average, but don't worry, it's okay. The reason I bring this up is because there's a sense in which you could imagine Jesus' words coming across this a little bit to the sinners. That they're there and there's this crisis moment. They hear the Pharisees grumbling and saying, why are you eating with these sinners? And they're like, here's the moment where Jesus stands up for us. And he says, well, these sinners are the reason I came. He doesn't say they're not sinners. Now, here's the deal. with me talking about, you know, seminary Dan being bothered by that teacher saying that, here's what maybe would have been the difference if it was a little bit fleshed out. What might have made the difference is if we came to the reality of her saying, you know, Dan, I don't know that you will ever be famous. I don't know that you'll ever be a television star. I don't know that you'll ever be a published author. I don't know that you'll ever have sort of the accolades of fame that would convince you that you are not average. But what I want you to know is that God made you uniquely in his image, and he loves you deeply for who you are, whether or not you ever become famous. Now, that's probably what she was trying to say. That would have landed, because that would have convinced me that even if in my own eyes and nobody else's eyes, I'm ever remarkable, I am still loved. Here is Jesus, and he doesn't say, these guys aren't sinners. Some of them would have been like, have you spent any time with us? Like, are you kidding me? We're like, we know this. We know this about ourselves. We know that we're sinners. We know that we're broken. Maybe some of them didn't. Maybe some of them thought they were the winners of society. But at least Matthew knew he was a sinner. He didn't have any qualms about that. The people who are offended by this idea are the people who don't think they're sinners. The people who aren't offended by this idea are the people who are already convinced that they are. And this all comes down to the crisis that Jesus is bringing us to, which is that the only people, oh, I'm sorry, I'll come back to that in a second. The only people who find Jesus are those who are already convinced that they need him. Matthew leaves behind his tax collector's booth and everything that goes along with it because he is convinced he needs Jesus. But anybody offended by Jesus calling them sinners would have only revealed that they were not yet convinced that they really needed him. You know, I think today we have other versions of the people that we kind of classify as sinners. We might not use the same terminology, but we all sort of know, like, all right, there's people in society that we would say, well, yeah, they sin, they're not perfect. But there would be other people that we'd categorize where like their life is marked by sin. Their life is marked sometimes by loud sin and unapologetic sin. There are certain people for us that we might put in categories that we might even consider to be a